You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or WXXC Truxton. Last week, Ithacans joined others from around the state in Albany to ask legislators to support a 5-year moratorium on the production and marketing of genetically modified food products and requiring labeling for milk from cows treated with bovine growth hormone. The delegation is also asking that more research funding go into organic farming methods instead of genetic engineering, which presently receives the lion's share. The moratorium legislation, New York Assembly Bill 5741 and Senate Bill 3016, are currently in their respective committees pending discussion in the Assembly and Senate. The moratorium would allow legislators, scientists, and research institutions to develop independent scientific protocols and priorities and to establish labeling for all products containing GMOs. Assembly Bill 3586 would require dairy products sold in New York State derived from cows that have been injected with RBGH to be so labeled. Monsanto and other biotech corporations have fiercely fought labeling laws for years, and so far have prevailed in quashing them, even though an overwhelming majority of citizens want these products labeled so they may make an informed choice at the grocery store. The licensing of RBGH was and remains controversial. The Organic Consumers Association recently put the issue in the spotlight again with a campaign to pressure Starbucks coffee houses to eliminate dairy products containing the additive. MSNBC's Your Environment column carried an article last month on the subject titled, "What's in Your Milk?" by Francesca Lyman. She wrote, "When she became pregnant with her son a decade ago, Ann Kute of Seattle worried that milk, boosted with genetically engineered hormones, could cause harmful side effects that might emerge later. While some thought she was being overly cautious, Kute stood strong and switched to organic milk free of such additives, never to return to conventional brands. Is she, and others who now boycott gene-modified dairy products, right? Do the added hormones, as the critics claim, pose serious health risks? People say, why go to all that trouble and pay more when there's no proof it's any better," Kute asserts. "I say, read about it and decide for yourself. Everything I've read since then has made me feel good about having started taking those precautions years ago," unquote. Health-conscious consumers like Kute are driving a boom in sales of organic and natural products, now the fastest-growing segment of the food industry. Such consumers are undoubtedly what made Starbucks respond to the March 20th boycott, aimed at getting them to stop using milk and dairy products made with recombinant bovine growth hormone, RBGH, a genetically engineered version of a growth hormone extracted from cows' pituitary glands that greatly increases milk output by as much as 20% to 30%. The company uses some 32 million gallons of milk per year in their coffees, milkshakes, and ice creams. Even if, quote, "some of our customers have concerns about the presence of RBST in milk products," CEO Oren Smith said, the company is taking, quote, "measures to address those concerns," unquote. Recombinant bovine somatotrophin, RBST, is another name for RBGH. But this isn't just for the health conscious, says Cummins of the Organic Consumers Association, who believes this campaign could revive long-dormant public opposition to the hormone-enhanced dairy products. Already, he says, new fears about mad cow disease and other ailments affecting the commercial livestock industry are fueling growing consumer demand for meat, milk, and dairy products labeled as organic, which come from cows that are not injected with RBGH. For a while, quote, "everyone forgot about RBGH, even though most Americans, when polled in 1996, said they considered it dangerous," says Cummins, citing a University of Wisconsin study revealing that 74% of American public considered the recombinant hormone a hazard, and 94% favored mandatory labeling. Today, says Cummins, speaking of activists who showed up at Starbucks protest sites in 100 cities earlier this month, they say, "I don't want any more hormones in my food, and I don't want to be part of a system that's cruel to dairy cows," unquote. According to Monsanto, which makes RBGH, the drug is injected into about 30% of U.S. dairy cows. The milk is shipped throughout the country, added to products such as cream, cheese, yogurt, and baked goods, but never labeled as such. Monsanto says that milk produced by RBGH is no different from natural milk in terms of safety. However, critics like Dr. Samuel Epstein, professor of environmental and occupational medicine at the University of Illinois School of Public Health in Chicago, point to dozens of studies that say otherwise. For example, Epstein charges, studies have shown that insulin-like growth factor, IGF-1, a protein that is present in slightly higher levels in milk from hormone-treated cows other than natural milk, has been linked to cancer in many studies. Another health risk, suggests William von Meyer, a retired Roman Haas chemist, is that the protein could enhance diabetes in people prone to the disease. The presence of a protein in milk could serve to prevent the hormone from being degraded right away, adds Michael Hansen of Consumers Union, which also opposes use of the drug. The more you look at this, the more questions arise, says Hansen. FDA dismissed such safety concerns years ago when it approved the drug in November 1993. After a long battle with activists and some small dairy farmers who oppose it due to health and safety concerns. Two FDA scientists concluded in the journal Science that no significant toxic side effects that would cause health harms were found among rats fed the hormone. In Canada, however, where RBGH was heatedly debated several years ago, government scientists who reviewed the data upon which FDA's approval of the drug was based came to a starkly different conclusion. Shiv Chopra is one of five government scientists at Canada's Health Protection Branch who found evidence that FDA had seriously overlooked, or he claims possibly even suppressed, studies showing adverse reactions in rats. Although the paper published in Science gave the product a clean bill of health, says Chopra, the U.S. FDA ignored the harder information, a 90-day study of rats showing that the hormone did indeed get absorbed into their bloodstreams, and that it produced antibodies and lesions. Chopra, who spoke to MSNBC shortly after a gag order was lifted regarding his speaking to the press, said, "I'm afraid to say that despite all that is known about the adverse reactions that cows have to the drug, and ample evidence of human health concerns as well, that the U.S. government took an expedient route to approval with the drug. The result," he adds, "have greatly benefited Monsanto." Chopra and the others authored a report opposing the drug, which he says the pharmaceutical giant was pressuring Canada to approve. In their so-called BST gaps report, the scientists found, for example, that not only was orally administered RBST absorbed into the bloodstream of these rats, but it also weakened their immune systems. They also pointed to the need for long-term toxicology studies to ascertain human safety. Another concern, they said, was farmers' tendency to give antibiotics to cows to counteract the drug's tendency to induce mastitis or udder swelling. And overuse of antibiotics in animals has been linked to the growing problem of antibiotics resistance. Based mainly on those concerns, Canada in 1999 rejected approval of the hormone. The decision came after a widely publicized scandal in which veterinarian and Health Canada reviewer Dr. Margaret Hayden testified to a Canadian Senate committee how her files on bovine growth hormone were stolen from her office. She also appeared on The Fifth Estate, a Canadian TV program, and alleged how Health Canada had been offered $1 million in research funding by Monsanto if the hormone were approved. In the United States, meanwhile, Canada's rejection of the drug unleashed an avalanche of criticism of the FDA and Monsanto. The Center for Food Safety and some 20 dairy farm organizations and other groups petitioned FDA to withdraw the drug, charging that more studies needed to be done to prove it safe. Two reporters, Jane Acree and Steve Wilson, tangled with their employers, Fox TV, over a documentary debating the safety of RBGH that was to air in Tampa, Florida. The reporters alleged that Monsanto prevailed over the TV management to censor and rewrite their script, so they sued. Last August, a jury agreed with the reporters and awarded Acree a $425,000 settlement. FDA stands by its approval, continuing to maintain that RBGH milk is no less safe than natural milk. We feel that there is natural IGF-1 in any milk, and against the background of IGF-1 in the body already, what's added in treated milk amounts to very little, Steven Sundloff at FDA's Center for Veterinary Medicine told MSNBC. The lesions that showed up in the rat study, says an agency memo, don't appear to be related to the RBGH the rats were also fed. The antibodies found in rat plasma were, quote, relatively low and, quote, not expected to have any adverse effect, unquote, FDA writes. Health Canada's Chopra disagrees. When lesions showed up in rats in Monsanto's study, that's precisely when FDA should have called for more studies, instead of subjecting the public to unknown risks without their knowledge and consent, he says. FDA may think this is an insignificant risk for the public, he charges, but they don't know because they haven't tested it fully. Close quote. And that was What's in Your Milk? By Francesca Lyman for MSNBC, published on March 29th. There are a number of dairies that have pledged not to sell milk from cows treated with BGH. In our area, Upstate Farms and Burn Dairy say they do not use hormones. Any product labeled organic should also be free of BGH. Unless specifically marked as organic or BGH-free, cheese manufactured in the U.S. should be presumed to contain it. To avoid ingestion of BGH, use only cheese from Canada or Europe, where BGH is outlawed. Stony Brook Farms yogurt sold locally is also clean. Ben & Jerry's ice cream, as well as Burn Dairy's, are supposed to be BGH-free. Please note, I say supposed to be, because without a lab test, no one can be sure about any American dairy product as long as the use of RBGH continues to be permitted. Our final speaker tonight is Dr. Robert Buller, Ware Professor of Sociology and Director of the Environmental Justice Resource Center at Clark Atlanta University. He's the author of Dumping in Dixie, Race, Class, and Environmental Quality, and Unequal Protection, Environmental Justice and Communities of Color. His research has focused on urban land use, community development, industrial facility siting processes, and environmental quality, and revealed alarming data demonstrating the disproportionate impact of waste facilities on poor communities of color in the United States. In 1990, he received the National Wildlife Federation's Conservation Achievement Award for his work in integrating the efforts of environmentalists and community action groups. And until recently, he served on the EPA's National Environmental Justice Advisory Council, where he chaired the Health and Research Subcommittee.
I'm pleased to be at Ithaca College. I'm a sociologist by training, and I'm an environmental sociologist. And I'm proud to say that I am an environmentalist, and I've been black most of my life. The topic that I will talk about this evening is very dear to me. When we talk about environmental justice, and when we talk about civil rights, and we talk about equity, these are issues that cut across all disciplines. Whether you're a toxicologist, hydrologist, epidemiologist, sociologist, journalist, it really doesn't matter. When we talk about environment, and we talk about environmental justice, The environment is everything. The environmental justice for all is the right thing to do. When we talk about the environment is everything. It's where we live, work, play, go to school, as well as the physical and natural world. The environment is out there, but the environment is also in this room. When we talk about the question of justice, fairness, and equity, we are really talking about communities and people having a right to a clean and healthy and sustainable environment. The whole question of the principle of environmental justice, this principle really embraces this concept that all people in all communities have a right to a clean and healthy environment. They have a right to ensure that all of our laws, environmental laws, health laws, housing laws, transportation laws, environmental laws, are equally enforced across the board without regard to race, color, national origin, spatial location. And we all know that all communities are not created equal. There are some that are more equal than others. If a community happens to be poor, working class, or a community of color, it receives less protection than a community that is affluent, that has a lot of power or access to power. Now, this is not rocket science. This is not rocket science. When we talk about this whole question of environmental justice, what are the major elements? Environmental justice includes enforcing the laws, equal enforcement, equal protection, eliminating disparities, whether those disparities are based on economics, racial or ethnic disparities, spatial disparities, whether these disparities are intended or unintended, doesn't matter. If the consequences are the same, doesn't matter if someone intentionally meant to poison you or intentionally meant to poison you. You can be just as dead. Environmental justice also involves bringing the people to the table and making sure that the people that are most impacted have a right to say no. Decision-making means a process by which you go through this scenario, options, alternatives. And at the end of the day, a community has a right to say yay or nay, yes or no. And so environmental justice basically means bringing impacted populations to the table so that they can be, number one, informed and make decisions based on that information. And having that information given to them, provided to them in a timely manner and in a user-friendly manner. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to give a community 5 volumes of an EIS and say, here, it's in the library. Say, give me your comments. That's the way it's done. And the results are very predictable as to what the outcomes are when you talk about comments. This whole question of looking at race, and I'm going to use the R word because I have tenure. Race still matters when it comes to the environment. All communities are not created equal. There are no landfills, garbage dumps, incinerators in Beverly Hills. It's just not there. Now, rich people produce garbage, produce waste. As a matter of fact, there is a direct correlation between per capita income and waste generation. Well, I'm not saying that poor people don't produce waste. What I am saying is that per capita, people with more resources produce more waste. We are a wasteful nation. We are a very rich nation, but we waste a lot. However, there's an inverse relationship between where the waste is disposed and per capita income. Poor people got more than their fair share of landfills, incinerators, freeways, garbage dumps, sanitary landfills. So when we talk about these issues of equity, fairness, and justice, a lot of it is us. We produce waste, and we waste a lot. And we in the environmental justice movement like to say a company that produces waste is a wasteful company. Think about it. Think about it. When you start closing the loop and minimizing waste, re-engineering so that you're not sending stuff or as much stuff, waste, to the landfill or to the incinerator, that means you are basically using what you have more efficient. So environmental justice is also about, it's also not only just about equity, it's also about efficiency. Racism is very wasteful. I'll say it again, racism is very wasteful. So when we talk about these issues, we're not anti-jobs, we're not anti-business, we're not anti-corporation, we're not anti-development. We're just anti-racism and anti-injustice. He says, Dr. Bullard, are you an activist? Are you a scholar? Are you an advocate? Yes. Even a child knows. When we talk about the issue of politics of pollution, and a lot of it is political, when we talk about the location and the siting of a locally unwanted land use, a LULU, such as a landfill or an incinerator or a petrochemical plant, oftentimes it is not the hydrology, it is not the toxicology, it's not the epidemiology. A lot of times it's the sociology of who gets what, when, where, why, and how much. And oftentimes the science involved in siting a facility and permitting that facility, the only science involved is political science. And political science is basically the art of power. So when we talk about this question of what's the science behind the location of this landfill in the middle of this low-income neighborhood, let's not look to toxicology and hydrology and epidemiology. Let's look to sociology and political science. This is not to say our brothers and sisters who are you know, looking at the chemistry of waste, that we also need to look at the politics of waste and waste disposal. When we talk about the history and the politics of race and place, and look at some of the landmark milestones that occurred, and I got involved in this issue way back in 1979, 2 years out of graduate school, 2 years out of Iowa State University in Houston. My wife's a lawyer. She's two years out of Drake Law School. This community came to my wife, black middle-class suburban neighborhood. I'm sorry, predominantly black neighborhood. That's like me saying my family is predominantly black. This is all black neighborhood. Suburban. 85% of the people own their homes. So this is not a ghetto. But this company, I'm not going to call any names, but the initials are BFI, wanted to put this sanitary landfill in the middle of this suburban, middle-income, African-American neighborhood. And the community said, no. You're saying our community is compatible with garbage, and therefore garbage is compatible with garbage. Houston, Texas, 1978, was the only city in the country, major city in the country, that did not have zoning. Even to this day, there is no zoning in Houston. Houston is the fourth largest city in the country. No zoning. What happens in Houston is called unrestrained capitalism. What does that mean? It means if you got the money, you can put it anywhere, anytime you want it. And so this community came to my wife, and my wife said, what do you want me to do? And they said, we want you to stop this landfill. No, they said, we want you to stop this garbage dump. And my wife said, okay, let's see what we can do. She came to me. She said, Bob, this community has come to me wanting me to file a lawsuit trying to stop this landfill. And I need someone who can collect data and help me on this lawsuit. I need somebody who works with census data who could actually plot and plant and lay out where the landfills are, because we don't know what's going on. And I said, wow, sounds like a lot of work. Now, before, she had no idea what I did, what a sociologist was. You know, sociology in her mind was someone who developed these grandiose theories and would go out, get a few graduate students, and go out and collect some data, bring it back, code it, put it through a computer, run it, write an article, and if you're lucky, write a book. And ultimately, you verify the obvious. That's what sociologists did. had no appreciation for what I did. I said, you need a sociologist. She said, that's what you do, right? That's how I got hooked, winked, suckered into this. 1978. There was no toxin release inventory database. There was none of this stuff was computerized. I had 10 graduate students that helped me go out and do windshield surveys, drive-bys. Now, we're not in L.A., okay? We can say drive-by. Drive-throughs. And look at and eyeball where landfills and incinerators were. Now, Houston is flat. It's below sea level. Anytime you see a mountain in Houston, you have to be suspicious. Old landfills. So we were able to document systematically where the landfills were and where the incinerators were. My wife filed a lawsuit. I worked for a Texas Southern University, a predominantly African-American university, state university. My wife sued the state of Texas, my employer. I didn't have tenure. Understand what I'm talking about? Young professor going around talking about where the landfills are, going to the city, going to the county, going to the state, trying to find out where the landfills are. BFI is headquarters in Houston. BFI, they make lots of donations to the university. I got called in. My dean asked me, we understand you're doing a study trying to find out where the waste landfills are. Is this sociology? I explained to him, yes, Dean, this is sociology. He said, go ahead and do it. This is 1979. I published an article in Sociological Inquiry in 1983. Solid waste sites in the Houston black community. That was the first article that looked at race and facility siting. Warren County, North Carolina was the first major national event that triggered a movement against environmental racism. North Carolina has 100 counties, and Warren County is predominantly black and poor. This company from New York went down to Raleigh, North Carolina, and brought this oil, and they were going to recycle it. But the oil was contaminated with PCBs. And so EPA's laws, regulations had changed in that they couldn't recycle it. So they just dumped it along the highways. North Carolina scraped it up in 1978. And they kept it piled and needed a place to put it. They finally found the best place to put it was predominantly black Warren County, North Carolina. 1983, the General County Office did a study at the request of the Congressional Black Caucus. And it found that in Region 4 in the South, 75% of the waste that was disposed, hazardous waste that was disposed in the South, in those eight states, was disposed in predominantly African-American communities, 75%. Black people only made up 20% of the population in the region. 75 versus 20%. That is disparate impact. That is disproportionate. 1987, the United Church of Christ did a study, Toxic Waste and Race in the United States. This was the first national study that looked at the implications of hazardous waste and race in the United States. This is not an academic institution. That's not a that did the study. It was not an environmental group. This was a civil rights group, a black civil rights group that did the study. And to this day, that study is held firm. It found that race was the most potent predictor of where these landfills and incinerators were located. It was not income. It was not property values. It was not housing values. And when they did a multivariate analysis and control for all the variables, the one single variable that came out on top was race. This is 1983 in Warren County, North Carolina, where the term environmental racism was coined. When we talk about this whole question in Houston, we say NIMBY. In Houston, what I found was Houston basically had two forms of waste disposal, landfilling and incineration. 100% of all the city-owned landfills were located in black neighborhoods. I'm sorry, predominantly black neighborhoods. And six out of the eight incinerators were located in predominantly black neighborhoods. So when you look at all the landfills and incinerators city-owned, three out of four of the privately owned landfills, when the city got out of the landfilling business, three out of four. So when you add up all the privately owned landfills and incinerators and city-owned, 83% of all the waste disposed in Houston was disposed in predominantly African-American neighborhoods. However, blacks only made up 25% of the population. 83% versus 25%. Now, that is disparate impact. That's what we showed in the article in 1983 in Sociological Inquiry. And so what we said, NIMBY has been replaced with a with this idea of PIBY, place in Black's backyard. When I wrote that article in 1983, I toned it down to get it published in Sociological Inquiry. And some of the edits that came back said, this is really strong. This sounds like racism. Now, I've never had racism in the articles. I thought if I put racism in it, it wouldn't get published. So they asked me to tone it back up. And I did. And I have toned it up since. When we talk about this whole question of invisible, racism makes some communities invisible. Even though this was a Black, middle-income, suburban neighborhood of homeowners, the landfill that was placed in this neighborhood was called Whispering Pines Sanitary Landfill. And there is nothing sanitary about a landfill. It's an oxymoron. When we talk about this whole question of, well, the reason why you get all these landfills and incinerators and locally unwanted land uses is because people are not, they don't pay attention, and these people are just poor, they're not organized. Well, that's a myth. We dispelled that myth when we developed a directory. I said, you know, I know there are groups out there working on this stuff. Native Americans, Latino American, Asian American, African American, Pacific Islanders working on this stuff. And so we put together a directory, people of color directory. And our directory showed that there are all kinds of groups working all over the country. And they're all over the map. The black dots represent groups that are African American groups. It's just, for some reason, all the black dots are located down south. Most of the Native American groups are located in the Midwest and the North Plain, where Native Americans are located. Most of the Asian groups are out west. So when you talk about the groups that are there, these groups are working all over. And what we did is we basically profiled the organizations, codified, showing what they're working on, and put it in a book and a report. These groups use this directory as a networking tool. We got it funded by the Mott Foundation. We have a new directory, just came out last year, 2000 issue. It's U.S., Mexico, and Canada, and Puerto Rico. It's a networking tool to show that people of color, environmental justice folks, we got to come together and work on this stuff on a global nature. When we talk about this whole paradigm, we have changed the way that environmentalism is done. We've changed the whole definition of the environment. A lot of our environmental brothers and sisters can no longer sit in a room that is very homogeneous, that is very suburban, and that is very insulated, and say, we represent the environmental movement. And we say to them, we're not trying to color coordinate anything. What we are saying is that we are talking about agendas that must be inclusive as opposed to exclusive. When we talk about our paradigm, shifting this paradigm, saying that environmental protection is a right. It is not a privilege. It is not enough to say, if you don't like it, you can leave and vote with your feet. Some people can't vote with their feet because of housing discrimination and because of limited incomes and because, in some cases, people saying, this is my homeland. I am not leaving the reservation. I am not leaving the barrio. I am not leaving my neighborhood, my community. And why should I leave? I have rights. Corporations are not people, they are not individuals, they are only creatures of the state. If you or I would go and pour dioxins, PCBs, chlorine down the water tower, drinking water tower for Ithaca, we would be labeled an environmental terrorist. We would be taken to jail. Do not pass go, do not collect $200. But some companies are given what's called a permit. And a permit is nothing more than a license to pollute in allowable limits. And they get permits to do it. Any of them taken to jail? No. And so when we talk about the balance between corporations and the rights of individuals, it is imbalanced. So the environmental justice movement paradigm have shifted the whole concept and the debate. Victims should not have to justify their victimization. People who have been poisoned should not have to prove that chemical X causes disease Y. Because if you use the epidemiological model, it is very difficult to isolate causation. So we will be spending all of our money trying to prove that this stuff is making us sick,
and that this company, X, is making us sick and not all these other things. And trying to blame us for smoking and eating fatty foods and drinking and doing all those things that are considered you are doing it to yourself, blaming the victim. So when we turn this paradigm on its head and said it is the responsibility of companies and it should be the responsibility of an industry to prove that this is safe. And we're saying, and we're still saying, we haven't gotten there yet, that the EPA should be using the FDA model. Before this thing comes online, it should be proven to be safe and not harmful. And if it is suspect, we should take what's called a precautionary principle approach. Get this stuff off the market. Now, I got stronger stuff, but I won't say it because I see the cameras looking at me. When we talk about this whole question of when did this paradigm shift take place, it took place in 1991. We had the first national People of Color Environmental Leadership Summit. It was a four-day meeting in Washington, D.C. And anytime you have a meeting in Washington, you know, you got to have a big demonstration on the Capitol. You just have to. I mean, that's the rules. And what we said is that people of color have to come together to define for ourselves what environmentalism is. And so the first 2 days of the four-day meeting, it was just people of color. African Americans, Native American, Latino American, Asian, and Pacific Islanders coming together saying, we don't know that much about each other. And slavery, racism, colonialism, paternalism, neocolonialism has done a job on a lot of us. And so before we can talk with everybody, we got to talk among ourselves. And so the second 2 days, we let everybody in. We let everybody in. We say this has to be a meeting that is inclusive. But before you can deal with real issues, we got to deal with issues among ourselves in terms of Native Americans not knowing that much about African Americans, African Americans not knowing that much about Latinos, in terms of our own mistrust of various groups, and well, we're fighting over this little affirmative action pie. It ain't about fighting over no pie. It's about making sure that we are all inclusive and not excluding anybody. At this summit, the delegates called the shots. We said we will define for ourselves what it is as our priorities. We will not let, you know, Sierra Club, National Wildlife Federation, Audubon Society, none of these white groups define for us what our priorities are. We will not let them lead our movement or lead our communities, etc. Now, this was not in a segregationist way. This was in an empowerment way. Before you can form a coalition among equals, you have to have equals. You have to have organized folks coming to the table with parity. Otherwise, you have this marriage that is based on a parent-child relationship or a subordinate-superordinate relationship, or this relationship that is based on a partnership. One is a silent partner and the other one is a junior partner. We say we're not going to create this kind of partnership. We want equal partnerships, and so that's how we're saying we have to build our movement. Our movement now is forming coalitions and alliances and collaboratives with all kinds of environmental groups. That's where our movement is the strongest, when we organize and work as a collective. Working with Greenpeace, anybody who would hang off of a bridge, tie themselves to whatever, and that's my kind of people. You know, working with NRDC, Environmental Defense, Sierra Club, Legal Defense Fund. Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund is now called Earth Justice Legal Defense Fund. Our movement has had an impact. Understand what I'm talking about. Justice has to be infused throughout our movement, our global movement. I was in The Hague a couple of months ago and at the climate summit. And there was an alternate summit called Climate Justice. We had people from all over. That was the real summit, the alternate forum. People talking about climate justice and the impact of certain types of regulations and rules on populations and the differential impact, the regressive impact, and how we have to organize and mobilize our communities to educate them that global climate change is a threat. It is a threat. And not let these lobbyists, coal lobbyists, infiltrate our black organization, our people of color organization, telling us that, well, if we implement the Kyoto Protocol, it's going to throw black people out of work and that this is just a white man's thing. Anybody who would believe that will believe somehow that just because your skin is dark that you can stay out in the sun all the time and not get sunburned. This is madness. This is crazy. This is pseudo. Understand, this is war. In terms of war of information dissemination. And as my grandmother told me, the first lie that gets out is the one that most people believe. And she also said, very smart woman, she said, in the absence of a plan, your plan is the plan. Listen to what I said. My grandma was smart. In the absence of a plan, your plan is the plan. There are a lot of places where there is no plan that are ripe for organizing and mobilizing. The issue of bringing people together. And as our laws and regulations get rolled back, pushed under, watered down with arsenic-laced water, by the way, we better watch out. Because, we can't live without water. So when we talk about these issues of justice, this is not just about people of color and poor people. It's about justice. This whole issue of how did the government respond and why did they respond? The government has never done anything for anybody. Just for the hell of it. It's always taken pressure, pressure, pressure. When EPA basically set up the Office of Environmental Equity, under the first Bush administration, by the way, when there were seven of us that went and met with William Riley, who was the EPA administrator under George Bush, the first Bush administration, William Riley said, what is this environmental justice and environmental equity? And we would say environmental racism, oh, he almost fell out the back of his chair. So they used environmental equity. You know, equity is a soft, soft. But the first Bush administration set up an Office of Environmental Equity. They did a report called Environmental Equity, Reducing Risk for All Communities. That was the first government report that acknowledged the fact that some communities are getting more than their fair share of environmental hazards, environmental threats. This is the Bush administration. So when we talk about this whole question of environmental justice, environmental equity, it is not a Democratic issue. It's not a Republican issue. So we're going to be putting, turning up the heat in terms of this administration. The fact is that there is no black air and no white air. We're all breathing the same air. So I don't think there's, places selling air yet. So when we talk about this issue, environmental justice and the government respond, all the things that we got from the EPA, including NEJAC, National Environmental Justice Advisory Council that I served on, NEJAC, not knee-jerk. Some of this stuff was knee-jerk. I mean, you blast these people and tell them what they're not doing, that they're not enforcing the law. We have some of the best environmental laws in the world. They're just not enforced rigorously in some places. So when we talk about equal enforcement, we talk about fairness, we talk about parity, it's not affirmative action. Environmental justice is not affirmative action. So when we talk about doing the things that we're talking about doing, it will help everybody. It will help everybody. But having laws on the books, having the best law, it's not enough. Not enough to have a great law. Oh, then we have the best laws in the world. We have some of the brightest minds in the world. If they're not used, we might as well have a bunch of dummies running things. In some cases, we do. When we talk about some of our laws, we have civil rights laws, we have environmental laws, we have, Clean Air Act. We even got the President of the United States to sign an executive order. We even got prestigious organizations to join in and say, we're going to do rigorous research on the issue of environmental justice. It's one thing to have this mouthy sociologist talking about environmental justice, one thing, and writing books and articles. It's one thing to say that. But in order for it to be respected and to be held out as science, get the National Academy. We got the Institute of Medicine to do a study. And the study was done in 1999. And what the Institute of Medicine basically found is what we found. There's some communities that's getting dumped on. There's some communities that are sick. And we got problems in terms of disease. Now, this is the National Academy. They said what we said. They published in the book. Oh, it's being quoted. Oh, it must be science. It must be real. Because we got some of the brightest minds at the National Academy to make sure that they get it right. You have to understand, you have to do what you have to do. So we got the National Academy to do this book. And basically, it supports the work that we're saying. having science and saying we're going to prevent, putting a sign up is not the same as being prevention. There's lots of places that, well, we fixed the problem, put a sign up, do not fish here. And what do you see? You see people fishing off the pier. People are not reading signs, or they say, well, hey, the fish I'm catching is not the fish that's contaminated. I'm taking this bad boy home. Some people are not anglers. Some people fish for protein to subsidize their budgets. And so, will a sign stop them? No. No. People will say, you're going to die from something. Who wants to live to be 150 years old? I got to feed my family. You understand what I'm talking about? This is not justice to have to choose between eating contaminated fish or starving. Or working in a plant you know will kill you on a job, as opposed to being unemployed. Poverty and unemployment are also hazards to your health. When we talk about this whole question, health is not for sale. People are mad. And just because you got facts doesn't mean that you're going to get anything or you're going to prove anything. There's a difference between scientific proof and proof in court. We got 30 years of lead poisoning data showing that lead poisoning is a health threat. It is the number one environmental health threat to children in the United States. Did Bob Bullock say that? No. The former Secretary of Health and Human Services, Louis Sullivan, said that in a report. It is still true. Lead poisoning is a preventable disease. We could prevent every case of lead poisoning right now. Lead poisoning affects low-income children and children of color 2 to 3 times greater than other children. Why? It's because lead paint right now is in urban, older inner city areas. We've gotten lead out of gasoline, so the only residuals are left is lead in the dirt, near freeways, in parks, near freeways, and in older housing, chipping paint. The problem is not that we don't have the science or the technology to remove and abate the lead poisoning. It's the problem is a political problem. We don't have a political will to abate the lead because people are saying, well, housing folks are saying, well, if we abate all the lead, we're going to make the housing too expensive for the people and create a homeless problem. So it's a choice between a homeless problem or a health problem. That is not justice to choose between a health of your children or housing. That's unfair, that's unjust, that's unethical, that's immoral. That's immoral. This is America. You should have a right to have decent, affordable, safe, sanitary housing. And to some extent, many of our public housing projects created problems in terms of lead. So it was not just industry that's doing it, it was also our own governmental agencies contributing to and exacerbating the problem. So when we talk about this whole question of politics of pollution, lead poisoning is one of those areas. Health problem, environmental problem, because lead is an educational problem also. You got to get the schools involved. You go to the school board, some of the school board members say, well, we don't deal with environment, we deal with education. Well, do you understand why Johnny can't read or why Johnny has a behavioral problem? And what do? They give him pills and drugs to slow him down. They treat an environmental health problem with chemicals. Let's be real. Now, this may not be happening in Ithaca, but it's happening in a lot of places. And it's impacting you in Ithaca because your health, your tax dollars will go toward paying for the problems that we don't solve. So it's an issue that impacts us all. Other people's waste, somehow when we talk about waste, it's almost like, well, where's the waste going? Do you know where your garbage is going? That's not a rhetorical question. Do you? It's leaving your house. It's not going into space. It's not evaporating. It's going somewhere, and it's probably going to a sanitary landfill or an incinerator. These are nice names, euphemism. An incinerator is nothing more than a facility that burns stuff. Burns stuff. And a landfill is nothing more than a dump. You can call it whatever you want to call it. Plastic liners, clay liners, technology, whatever. All these things will leak. Eventually, they will leak. So when we talk about this stuff, we're talking about real things and real environment. All communities are not created equal. This is a map of Metro Atlanta, and the yellow represents less than 10% minority. The red represents over 50% minority. The dots represent polluting facilities. The bigger the dot, the more the pollution. Look where the big dots are. Most of the big dots are in where the red, mostly African American. When we talk about all communities are not created equal, these are two heavily populated counties in Metro Atlanta. Same thing. The yellow represents less than 10% minority. The red represents predominantly African American. The red is all these dots and waste facilities and air permits and hazardous waste sites are located in the red. Understand that all communities are not created equal. And it's not just low property values that's driving these things toward certain areas, because in Houston, this was not a low-income poverty pocket. Middle-income, African-American, suburban neighborhood. When we talk about this whole question of pollution and permits, we're talking about a license to pollute. We're talking about living with pollution, in some cases, dying from pollution. Non-attainment areas. We talk about people where you live can impact your quality of life. There are a lot of white people who are living in urban areas that are non-attainment. The report that was done in 1991 by the Argonne National Lab, it showed that nationally, 57% of whites, 65% of blacks, and 80% of Latinos lived in a non-attainment area. That's a lot of folks breathing dirty air. And dirty air has consequences. Our behavior contributes to that process and that problem. And automobiles, major contributor to pollution. When we talk about this whole question, it's not just industries that we're talking about, it's also us. And anytime we have areas that don't have good, clean, efficient, affordable mass transit that's automobile dependent, you're going to have air quality problems. Like Los Angeles, like Houston, like Atlanta, like Dallas. All of the big cities in Texas are now non-attainment. And we won't say when that happened, but it happened. We won't give any credit or fault to anyone. But if you live in any of those cities, you are breathing dirty air. Bad air hurts. We're spending over $10 to $200 billion a year because of air pollution. Now, depending on who you talk to, you get the figures. So we're talking about spending a lot of money, depending on which figures you believe, on air pollution, health cost. And so when we talk about this issue, lost school days. For example, asthma accounts for 10 million missed school days, 1.2 million emergency room visits, 15 million outpatient visits, and over 500,000 hospitalizations each year. Asthma is creating lots of problems, and a lot of it is environment related. No, I am not saying NOx, SOx, PM10, PM2.5 is causing asthma, no. But it's not health enhancing. Asthma impacts African Americans 3 to 4 times greater than for whites. African Americans die from asthma 5 times greater than whites at every income level. Asthma is at an epidemic proportion in every major metro area in this country. So when we talk about, you know, can we strengthen clean air, and any black person or person of color talking about, oh, that's a white man's thing, I mean, I'd be ready to get in the face quick and say, you better talk, brother and sister. Strengthen the Clean Air Act will help us in disproportionate in terms of benefits. You clean up cities in terms of air, that's where we are. We are concentrated in cities. So when we talk about strengthen clean air, or you talk about impact on water quality, et cetera, these are issues that people of color somehow thought was just white environmental issues. And so we had to turn that thing around and show it's all of our issues. Transportation is an issue, a major issue in terms of where we live, where we work, and where we play. And other than housing, transportation is one of the biggest. So when we talk about housing, we talk about transportation, mobility, access to jobs, these are all environmental issues. And if we're so dependent upon fossil fuels and automobiles, 30% of African Americans nationally don't own cars. We use transit. And a lot of it is because of we are forced to use transit because of our incomes, and others by choice. So when we talk about transit, it is an alternative to driving. When we talk about the cost of sprawl, we have a new book, and this is not a commercial, But sprawl is creating lots of problems. No, I'm not saying sprawl causes all the urban problems. No, but sprawl causes a lot of environmental problems. Increases traffic, drives up the cost of transportation. The most sprawl-threatened cities are the cities also that have the highest transportation costs. You spend more in sprawl-threatened cities because you got to drive. Sprawl also destroys forests and green space. Here's an example when we talk about Atlanta. I moved from Atlanta, you know, as I said, I moved from Atlanta 6 years ago from L.A., and I really didn't leave L.A. Atlanta is becoming L.A. Freeways, highways, gridlock, air pollution. You're talking about this whole question of loss of green space. Each week, 500 acres of green space in metro Atlanta is being plowed under to make way for mega malls. We're in love with malls. We want to be the biggest, we want to have the biggest mall. Mall of Georgia. I mean, it's like, why do we need another mall? How much money do we have? And none of the malls have access to public transportation. We're making roads and highways. We're just destroying. It's madness. So when we talk about the investments in transportation, you're talking about investments in the future. You're talking about equity. And there are transit disparities. Disparities that create additional disparities. Transit doesn't go everywhere. It doesn't go where the jobs are. When we talk about fares, I mean, this is diesel, where the diesel buses are. I mean, when we divide up, we have a major lawsuit that we're working on. We don't organize any lawsuits, but when people call us, we respond. We don't run away from a fight. When you divide the service area up, almost all of the compressed natural gas buses, the clean fuel buses, are located in the affluent white areas. Almost all of the diesel buses are serviced and housed and operate in predominantly black areas. Now, that is disparity. That is Jim Crow. That is separate and unequal. It's one system. So when you talk about this whole issue, New York City, you know, in Manhattan, the same way. You know, 7 out of 8 of the bus shelters in Manhattan are located in Harlem. So when you talk about diesel buses, diesel fume, you're talking about carcinogenic fumes coming out, schools being located next to bus barns, the impact, asthma. I mean, these are issues that people are not, you know, generally aware of. When we talk about Atlanta, we have mobilized and organized a whole bunch of groups, and they file lawsuits. As I said before, we don't run away from lawsuits. We have been able to pull together groups from various diverse areas. Civil rights groups that generally don't work together, SCLC, Urban League, you know, NAACP, Rainbow Push, all kinds of groups, to sign on to this complaint. And when we talk about this whole question of safety, I mean, there are communities right now that are supposed to be cleaned up, Superfund sites, and there are signs that are left in the yards and along the ditches, do not dig. That's like saying, kid, don't be a kid. Don't go outside and dig in the ground, play, whatever. And so they have signs in people's yards saying, they cleaned up the site, but these signs are left. When we talk about this whole issue, West Dallas, Texas, for example. We worked on this case in 1982. West Dallas was poisoned with lead smelters for 50 years, 3 studies. And then when they finally clean up, they come in moon suits, dig, clean up the lead. This whole question of some communities are endangered. Trying to mine in the Grand Canyon. You ever been to Grand Canyon? There are people who live in the Grand Canyon, Havasupai, native people, been there for thousands of years. They want to mine. So when we talk about these issues, where you want to put a uranium dump, there was a plan to put a uranium dump on the Colorado River, on the Mojave Tribe Reservation. And when it found out that, hey, it's not just going to affect a few Indians on the reservation, it's going to affect 14 million people who get their drinking water from where? From the Colorado River in Southern California. Oh, we got to do something about this. Well, it's not just poisoning Indians. Understand that it all flows downstream. The issue of justice, fairness, equity, it's also in Alaska. Native folks in Alaska, right? Military toxins. The barrels that this native indigenous woman is standing was left, no, not by some company, it was by the government. So when we talk about these issues of justice, fairness, and equity, it's all over. It's all over. And what we're saying is that the issues must stop. People are saying no to poison, and they are winning. This community in Louisiana fought this company, multinational, German, English, and American, that wanted to put this uranium enrichment plant in the middle of that community. This company spent $35 million, and they lost. The community won a decision in front of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission that denied this permit based on environmental justice, based on the executive order, saying this is environmental discrimination, and race had a part in selecting the site for this particular area. And the EIS, the report said, there are no people out here. This is, you know, just forest land. Two communities had been there since 1865. Say, we're real. 1865. So the issue of racism making certain communities invisible, and people are saying, we have a right to say no. It's a right. It's not a privilege. And if an area does not want a nuclear uranium enrichment plant or a nuclear waste dump or an incinerator, they have a right to say no. And no company or no governmental agency has a right to force that on them. Now, that's what environmental justice is all about. And that's what the work that we're doing and that I've been doing for the last 20 years, saying people have a right to say no. They also have a right to say yes. If somebody wants to take a garbage dump and make money in terms of the community, that's their right. But they should have all of the facts up front to make that informed decision. That's what environmental justice is. We're not trying to close anybody's, you know, plant down in terms of, well, you know, we're not for jobs. That's just bunk. Environment, people have a right to clean air, clean water, safe playground, safe home, livable wage, clean workplace, here as well as abroad. When we talk about synchronizing these laws, these universal laws, or making them universal, we're not saying it stops at the U.S. border. It doesn't stop at the U.S. border. What we do, what these companies that are happening, poisoning people in Norco, Louisiana, Shell Oil, it's the same Shell Oil that's poisoning people in Ogoni, Nigeria. Same Dutch-owned company. Texaco the same way. Same Texaco that's poisoning folks down in Ecuador. Same Texaco in the south coast of L.A. So when we tackle these problems, they have to be tackled in a global sense. We just can't say, well, ship the waste, you know, ship the spare parts from all of our computers to China or Taiwan, because I'm through with my computer. A lot of this stuff is going to the Philippines, lead batteries, going overseas, going to third world country. Understand, it's about justice, fairness, equity, at home as well as abroad. Thank you very much.
That was Robert Bullard, professor of sociology and environmental justice at Clark Atlanta University. He spoke last month in Ithaca.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
But that won't be my end, for my guns and my saddle will always be filled by unwelcome